This is Good News Chats with Dr. Ken Tangen.
Hi, this is Ken Tangen, and this Good News Chat is with Marv and Cole. Hey, Marv, how are you?
I'm fine. How are you, Ken?
I'm doing good.
Good.
So where exactly are you?
I am in Yakima, Washington, on the eastern side of the mountains.
Ah.
Yeah, where we have a lot of sunshine, although this summer has been a cool one, and we've had about the coldest spring we have in, for 20 years. Now, but the fruit is doing well. The cherries are all picked, and they're beautiful.
Ah, yes, cherries and apples from Yakima.
Yeah, they're famous for that.
So did you grow up in a Christian family?
I did. I had the good fortune of growing up with even Christian grandparents. I happened to run across, we get a lot of books into the jail, old things, and I happened to run across a couple every once in a while, and I thought, oh, I remember that. And then I ran across one the other day, the testimony of Warren F. Fox. I know that name. I heard that when I was a kid. So I picked it up and read his story, and then I ran across another name in there, Dr. Charles S. Price.
Ah, yes.
Uh-huh. Now that goes back, because that's, I think, when a lot of our family got introduced to the Lord. My Uncle Harry and some of those who were, he held tent meetings in Tacoma. Actually, I got Christian grandparents on both sides of the family, so that's an awesome blessing.
How did you become a Christian?
I grew up in a Christian home, and I was in Sunday school. So I was a Sunday school boy. Perfect attendance year after year. You know how that goes. I didn't murder anybody. I was just a plain old kid in Tacoma. Born during the Depression, 1929. And grew up in humble circumstances, but we never lacked. We always were fed. And actually, the first church, the one that I really was formed in, was the it was called the Pentecostal Tabernacle on South 12th and G Street. The pastor I remember most was Dwight H. McLaughlin, though there were others who were earlier in the church. But he was in my teen years when it was when I lost my father. He married up and so forth.
So was there a moment in time that you became a Christian?
Yes, there was a time I remember I came under great conviction, and I was just, well, my dad had some chickens. We had about 30 chickens, and I can remember sitting out in the chicken house with the chickens walking around me wondering what's the matter with me. I had no assurance of salvation, and I was in agony, and I hadn't really, I loved the Lord, but you know, and I prayed, but there came a time of deep conviction where God really got hold of me. I was in junior high school. I think I was about 13, probably, 12, 13. That was a changing point in my life.
Mm-hmm.
Changed my grades in school, even.
So what has surprised you about being a Christian?
I guess I really wasn't surprised, because I had been, I heard the gospel, heard missionaries, and different people speak, and so I was expecting something different and change. Maybe a little bit of the surprise came within my own ranks in the church, young people our age, when my wife and I, we were just going together. So we met early in life. She was 13, I was 16, and she was in the same church. And so when we really decided we wanted to follow God and give our lives wholeheartedly to Him, it wasn't always the unbelievers that we got opposition from. It was people, I always remember a statement, "Oh, you're an old man before your time." Yes, we didn't want to do what everybody else was doing.
Was there a godly person in your life who greatly impacted you?
One of the men that impacted me most was junior Sunday school teacher by the name of Ed Hanch. Ed Hanch was a lumberjack in the forests of Washington when men were men and trees were big trees and there were no chainsaws, you know. It was all axes and crosscut saws.
Mm-hmm.
So he taught our Sunday school class at junior boys. He prayed for all his boys. He probably wouldn't be allowed to teach in this church now. He was very humble, not highly educated, but he really knew how to relate the Word of God to human life. And so he'd illustrate the stories, the scriptures, with stories out of the woods. I always remember one particular. He's talking about this man in the a fellow lumberjack who was waving his fist in God's face. There's no God, he says. If there's a God, let him strike me dead. And Ed says to us junior boys, he says, who does this guy think he is? He's going to tell God to come down and strike him dead? God doesn't have to come and strike him dead. About 2 weeks later, a cable on the donkey engine snapped, and it whisked and just cut the top of his head right off. He just fell over, and we picked up the top, scooped up his brains, put him back in his head, and, you know, you don't mess with God. We're all, oh, you don't mess with God. Not the message, you know? he talked about his boys, you know, a lot of them, I think at least six of them went into the ministry out of his class. But he's a great teacher because he was a man's man, and he really got us our attention.
So how did you get from there to prison?
Well, it's a long road. I spent 31 years in South America, in Paraguay, as a missionary working among the native people. And then in 86, we came home, not certain of what we'd be doing, because by that time we'd worked in three different languages, in Spanish, Guarani, and Macaw, an unwritten language. And then we were over in Tacoma, and we spent 6 months there trying to decide what we're going to do. In the meantime, I was pouring concrete, building house foundations for a friend I'd worked for before, and teaching at church on the weekends. And then I got a request to come over here and look over the Hispanic ministry at the American Missionary Fellowship. And so we came over and looked it over and decided to come over and join with them over here. Right away, I got involved in the jail as a volunteer because the jail chaplain at that time, his daughter knew my daughter-in-law, and he invited me in because I spoke Spanish. And so on Saturdays, he taught on one side of the wall in English. I taught on the other side in Spanish. And then eventually, I ended up becoming the senior chaplain. So I've been senior chaplain there for the last 16 years.
So did you like being a missionary?
I did. Yes, definitely. I'm still in contact with folk down there. Things have changed. Now I can pick up my cell phone and hit the name under Andy, and the Indian chief down in the village answers me. That isn't the way it was when we were there. It took about 3 weeks to get a letter, you know.
Yeah.
My mother died. I got the telegram a week after she was buried, and I didn't even know she'd died. Speed, time does change things.
That's true. As a policy of full disclosure, I should say that you are my cousin of some form or other.
Yes, second cousin, something like that.
Or first cousin once removed, or one of those. Yes, I never know.
But your mom was my first cousin. She was a daughter of Uncle Fred, who was my dad's brother.
Now, the Cole family had a number of ministers come out of it. And my mom and dad went to China as missionaries.
They always impacted me for some reason. Your mom and dad had a special place in my dad's heart. And my dad's wasn't a writer or anything, but I always just, there's a vivid recollection of him sitting at the table writing to your parents in China. That's me for some reason. It grabbed me. And I remember them coming home on furlough and being in our front yard. I still got some pictures of that. And then I ended up actually being in a class of missions that your dad taught.
Oh, really?
Yes, I did, at the Northwest Bible College.
So how did you decide to go to South America? How did you decide to become a missionary?
Well, you know, I never really planned to be a foreign missionary. I had this idea in my head I wasn't called, you know?
Mm-hmm.
No bright lights, no nothing woke me up at night and said, go to Paraguay, you know? I was thinking rural missions. My first summer out of school, I went to Montana to a place called Troy and worked with my brother-in-law and sister who were starting a pioneer work there in that little town. I worked on the railroad while I was there that one summer. And actually the courses I took, believe it or not, when I was in Bible school, I took foreign missionary course. Not ever planning to be a foreign missionary, but I took a course in tropical disease nursing. I wore that book out later on in South America. I'd never planned to be that. I didn't think it was for me. But after I graduated that summer, I went down to California to the American Soul Clinic in Huntington Park, a course taught by a man named Fred Jordan. And when I was there, we were out witnessing all the time and whatnot, but a missionary group came through there from New Tribes Mission. the wife, the widow of the founder, and there were some missionaries with them who showed movies of Indian work in Brazil. And that really got me. I mean, it's just, it wasn't, you know, an incredible impression, like, whoa. I have to think about that. My wife was in Tacoma waiting the arrival of our first child, and I just sent her some of the literature. Well, she was already gung-ho long before I was to, and because we'd always grew up around missions and missionary speakers and things. So I just sent the material to her, but when I got home, we talked more about it and felt that was the thing God wanted us to do. And so we started moving in that direction and ended up at New Tribes Mission Boot Camp, a year training course. At that time, they had out of Willows, California, straight up in the Mendocino Forest. We spent a year up there in mission training where we were taught survival techniques, so to speak, and translation, New Testament church principles, that sort of thing.
Your mission experience was a pretty harrowing experience.
Yeah, we've been through some things, I guess you would say. Our first term, when he went down to Paraguay, and we didn't, you know, we were raised in the Assembly Church, and my brother, Glenn, you know him, he was younger, and he was off in finishing up at Central Bible Institute in Springfield. I think he was about in his last second year, maybe, when we were there at the camp. And then while we were at camp, actually that summer I left, we fought forest fires because the training camp was in a forest, national forest area, and one of the conditions where we'd have a hotshot crew ready to go at a drop of at a moment's notice. So I was one of the straw bosses on the firefighting. And that summer when we left, and then the next fire out, we lost 11 of our men in a fire.
Got
canyon, so we knew half of them. I ended up working with one of them who survived that fire and married one of the widows, and they ended up in Paraguay about 6 months after we got there. We went out trusting God. We didn't have support really like a traditional missionary. In fact, we had one promise support of $20 a month when we left, and that person never did give a dime all the time we were there. But anyway, God always met our needs. The first 9 months, I was administrator of the mission because they never had a house in town. They were deep interior, and they would fly in because the mission had a plane. And they would fly in and do their shopping, and we realized we needed a place in town as an office, someone to handle all the paperwork and things. So I ended up with that job the first 9 months. That's how I learned Spanish the hard way, going in and trying to buy something. There's a lot of laughable things that happened at that time. And then we went up on the Bolivian border for another 9 months with the Chamococo Indians. There we had three languages. We lived right on the border, Brazil, Bolivia, Paraguay, and so we heard Chamococo, Spanish, Guarani, and Portuguese. That's an interesting combination. So then we came back, and we were wanting to open up a work in eastern Paraguay with the Ache Indians, who were still in the Stone Age. So we went out and lived there near the edge of the forest and worked with the Paraguayan community, where we worked with Guarani and Spanish, with the idea of eventually moving out with the Ache, which was still in the contact stage. At the end of that time, the mission asked me to come back to the States to go to University of Washington with Wycliffe Linguistics and study linguistics. So when that happened, we would be ready to do that. So we were in the capital city, ticket in hand, ready to fly the following week when our oldest son was getting off the streetcar, and he accidentally jumped before the streetcar stopped, hit an orange tree, fell under the streetcar, and took off his left leg below the knee. And so I picked him up out of the street with 6 inches of his leg missing and his foot swinging on the tendons. And we rushed him to the hospital, and God met his need. He never lost consciousness all that time, so he had some nightmares after that. But that's a story in itself. Where's God when that happened? I've had people ask me that, you know, hey, I'm serving you, I'm going home to get more training, and now, why this?
Mm-hmm.
The only question my son asked was, why did I jump off the streetcar? But he never lost consciousness, so I remember when we went to the hospital, and he he was talking to me on the emergency table, the doctor there. I didn't know he understood English, but he did. And my son is saying, Dad, am I going to die? No, I said, son, you're not going to die. But I said, if you did, it'd be okay, wouldn't it, because you go to be with Jesus. Yeah, it would be. He was real positive. He was just, he knew the Lord. I heard later, by way of the grapevine, that doctor really got shook up that day, because when he heard that, it rocked him real bad in his faith. Good heavens, how can that be, that that child would speak like that with no fear?
We'll have more with Marvin Cole right after these announcements. Today's Good News announcement comes to us from St. Paul in Romans chapter 8, verse 38 to 39. I have become absolutely convinced that neither death, nor life, nor messenger of heaven, nor monarch of earth, neither what happens today, nor what may happen tomorrow, neither power from on high, nor power from below, nor anything else in God's whole world has any power to separate us from the love of God in Jesus Christ our Lord.
That's the end of our announcements.
That's the end of our announcements. That's the end of our announcements.
That's the end. That's the end. That's the end. That's the end.
No more.
So, Marv, when do you feel closest to God?
When do I feel closest to God? Wow, that's a good one. Well, I suppose when I'm in the Word and the Word is becoming real to me, there, I have a comparison, I guess. Worship services, and some of the closest times I've ever felt close to God have been in jail. I remember one worship service on the third floor, and they were... I'm trying to think if it was in Spanish. I think it was a mixture of Spanish-English. And one of the gentlemen asked if he could play, borrow somebody's guitar. There were about 40 there. And he sang a song, and it was in Spanish, but it's called One Day at a Time. Un día a la vez in Spanish. But he was typical of some of the men who fought drugs and up and down, back and forth, and in the prayer, the song was his prayer, and it's just like it came from the shoelaces, from the depths of a soul. And he just sang that out with agony and passion, and he sang well and played well. But I tell you that it was like something stepped into the room that was, you know, there was power. And I mean, you look around, and there's hardly a dry eye in that place. It was like he prayed and sang a song that was the prayer of everybody in the room, and there were tears in these men's cheeks. That was one of the places where I sensed a great awe of the presence of the living God in a situation that, you know, is not always the best.
Mm-hmm.
I've got sitting here on my desk a printout from another man where this just happened this week, and this came to me today, and I'm getting one from every day. This man is in being charged for murder. We have several of those, but this gentleman has met the Lord, and he's on the fourth floor, and it's in a place where there's a lot of darkness. And he said, your Bible gift was the most gracious gift, a wonderful Bible study notes that have helped me. And he talks of the other men around him. He said, I got a group of blacks on one side in lockdown and Hispanics on the other, and they knock on my door at night and ask me how I'm doing or what am I doing. I'm reading the Bible, taking notes. And then he says, I pass notes to them under the door. So he says, now they're there every morning waiting to be fed under the door by some notes I pass to them. Then I got a note from one of the other men who he's talking to. And he says, dear chaplain, I'm working with Mike. Can I please receive a Bible and my New Life Christ lessons? That's a correspondence course for you. I'd like Mike to help me. We want to start a Bible class. Right now I want to get on board with Mike. And David, I love these conversations and messages I'm hearing. Or top security, accused murderer teaching the class. That's why I keep going back to jail.
Have you ever experienced a miracle or seen an angel?
Have I ever seen an angel? No, I never have. You know, I've been where there's a lot of demon presence in the jail. I remember waking up. I'm not in jail, but well, yeah, there too. There's a lot of that. But in the Indian village, I remember one night I woke up about 1 in the morning, north wind was blowing, and it brought the sound of the drum and dance beat that was up at the other end of the village. And I knew the voice. It was the dance chief, Ornorio. But in his voice, there was another voice, and I can just strictly remember the hair on the back of my neck just stood up. And, there was an obvious demonic presence. That I'm very aware of. What I am aware of is that not having seen angels, but being aware of the fact that you can live in an atmosphere and an environment and trust God to take care of you. And I have really been more confirmed in that by people involved in witchcraft and a witch doctor who said he was always telling another friend of his who was related to him, who was involved in witchcraft, and he was and been hexed or cursed, and he was dying. And we had him into the hospital, checked everything out. The doctor said there's nothing wrong with him except that he's dying. He's just wasting away the skin and bone. And so he stayed at our house outside the village for a couple of weeks. That's when we lived outside the village after 6 years living in it, and we went back and forth every day. And when he stayed with us, he got better. He looked like a new man. He went back to the village, and the week he looked like skin and bone again. And his witch doctor's stepbrother, told him, when you go to the missionary's house, I can't do anything. So if you want me to help you, don't go to the missionary's house, because when you're there, I can't do anything. We had confirmation that the believers do not realize the power of God and the influence they have on a society. When Jesus says we're the light of the world, the salt of the earth, that's no joke. We mess up Satan's work on earth. And when you live in an Indian village where there's six packs and witch doctors, And there's always this element in the village. It isn't that you see demons or ghosts, although they were seeing them, and we had a lot of instances of that, but where God gives you a quietness of heart in the midst of that type of atmosphere. That, to me, is not just seeing angels, but knowing they are with you, God's with you, and that you can depend on him and move your family in there with four or five children in that kind of an environment and be safe.
What size church do you attend?
What church do I attend? Now I attend the Westside Church. It's actually a conservative Baptist church. It's we're having four services on Sunday, so we're growing. We're right up, I don't know, if everybody, all the people attend, there are probably 1,200.
Mm.
And given Sunday, there's probably 800 to 1,000 in four different meetings. So there's an 8 o'clock service, a 9:30 service, 11:30, and then a 5:30 p.m. service. They're all a little bit different.
Mm-hmm. How did you pick it?
Actually, the man that was chaplain at the jail whose daughter knew my daughter-in-law was that from that church. That's really the connection.
Mm. So, Marv, what drives you crazy about Christians?
We're not going to talk about the music, huh?
Anything you want.
Well, I don't know if they drive me crazy. I think sometimes they're a little bit blind. I think the materialism aspect that is a real curse to our generation, that we get so wrapped up, and then all of a sudden the whole economy start rocking, and whether we're going to all go under financially. That's something that God dealt with us early on. It was Matthew. We went to the field in the first place under the strength of Matthew 6 and looking to God to provide. And so hasn't been a thing that bothered us, is when you come home, we never fit anywhere. With city innovation, it's like, man, it's a boring conversation. You know, my next car, my next yacht, my this, my that. And it was the materialistic aspect of our society that it was always, because we know too many people. We know what poverty is, and we know so many people in need that it's hard to connect in our. So we never really, in a sense, feel like we belong, sort of.
Mm-hmm.
Like you know, who are we going to talk to? We're kind of always sitting on the edge a little bit.
Right. That's not uncommon for missionaries, is it?
No, I don't think so. I know we'd go first, and my wife would sit there and cry. You know, there's a missionary come to church and speak, and she's sitting there crying, what am I doing here, you know?
Yeah. I think it's even harder on missionary kids.
Yes, yes, and that's a whole subject in itself, isn't it? You know, you've been one of them. You are one of them. And I've got six of them, so, and they've all got stories of, but they've always got their interesting circles. I don't think any of them would change what they've been through, but it does present its own challenges. And now the new society, Facebook, has changed so much my God, one of my daughters, she knows more about anything than I. You know, I can't. Won't you hear that? Facebook. And she comes up with news. Well, I talked to so and so. You talked to who? All her. She's connected with all the kids that she used to go to school with down in Paraguay.
That's great.
Oh, kind of. Yeah. Wow. So that's neat. That's been a help to them in the sense of being able to connect with people who understand what they're talking about.
What can you do now that you couldn't do as a child?
Well, you know, economically, we are way better off than my parents were. You know, as far as economy, I was 1929, and I have two cars sitting out by my house. My wife drives one, I drive the other because she's busy and transporting. And so, you know, my dad had a car once in a while, but usually it wasn't too good a car. So we travel like, you know, my parents were not able to travel like we travel. And the world has shrunk. And so we, I suppose in a way, it's a comparison. We're rich compared to our parents.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the pay scale and the economy, even as bad as it is. And that's another thing that we've enjoyed. We, on the field, and on the mission field, we got along with, very slim pickings. I always had a garden and I fed our family and usually another missionary. But God is, we have people supporting us who have supported us for over 50 years. And we are able to give and bless other people. And that's, to me, is amazing. That's, you know, why every time I do my income tax, I look at, honey, look at this. This is awesome. I mean, this is impossible. But God blesses, and He says what he does what he says he's going to do. You give and give, and it'll be given unto you. Good measure, pressed down, shaken together. Men give into your bosoms, and God has really done that. We've been able to share, and God makes that possible. I don't mean like we give in order to get, but God has blessed us. So that's different than our parents. My parents were generous. My dad was a generous man in this with what he had. We lived near the railroad tracks, for example. And we had what we call bums in those days, hobos, come by our house. And one cold winter, one came, and my dad wouldn't send them away. He would feed them. And I don't remember this, but my brother, older brother, wrote about it, that dad went in and got him his only and best overcoat and gave it to him. And I thought, my dad understands missions and caring. You know, he died when I was 16. But that rang a bell. That's a little bit of history that means a lot to me. I'm not really a denominational man. I believe in the family of God who love the Lord are born again. And so God has moved us into circles like that in the jail, especially you serve everybody in the jail. We serve those who don't believe like we do. We have Muslim people in jail. We have every kind of thing you can think of. And my role as a chaplain is to serve all of them. So, and we do that. We have also what we call a God Pod program. So we have a tank of 60 men who are in there by choice, and the tank is the classroom. They live in that tank together 24 hours a day. In the women's program, there's 22 women in it. And that program is really is a story in itself. A whole lot of things taking place there that God has really blessed. But you have to serve the community. You serve denominational lines and try to live Christ, teach Christ, and love them all.
Have you enjoyed the cultural changes in the church, from the type of music to the style of interaction, or have you found that concerning?
I found it. Because I've been culturally, I've learned to fit into cultures. I have a hard time fitting into my own culture, honestly. I do better in an Indian culture, Hispanic culture, but the music has been a pain to me. One of the things that really bother me, for example, what would you feel like if someone sang the national anthem but decided to change the music?
Mm-hmm.
What would be the impact in your thinking as your psyche, as you listen to that?
It shifts it too much?
Yeah, like, well, who authorized him to change that? And what's the matter mm-hmm. with the hymn the way it was? The whole world sings it that way. And the other thing is that the music, the tune, and the words are married together in the other side of your brain. One pastor, for example, this is true. He was a pastor over 50 years, knew hundreds of hymns. He had a stroke, never spoke another word in his life. So they died, but he could still sing word perfect every hymn he knew. So what I'm saying is the words and the tune are married. So when they decide to, they take an old hymn of the church and decide to change the music to it, you know, it does a number on me because I'm trying to sing it, but the words are married to the tune, and I'm, oh boy, wait a minute. That's a big shift. But that's, you know, the world's changing, and us old people have to step aside and get out of the way. People let them do what they do, and we try to bless them and not let it bother us. It's just, I don't think they understand, from our perspective, how hard that is. I've sung hymns for 50-plus years with a tune, and the tune and the words are married. They're together. You can't pull them apart.
Well, Marv wonders what I'm going to ask next. It's time for the offering.
You wonder what song to sing or what?
Actually, it's just a chance for me to thank the people listening for their generosity. People have donated their time and talent for this project, and so I'm just taking this moment to say thanks.
Thanks. Thank you very much. Thank you very much.
Thank you. I mean,
thank you very much.
Yeah, thank you.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
So, Marv, has God put a particular issue or cause on your heart?
But right now, what I've been thinking about and praying about for the last several weeks is I've got a son who's fighting prostate cancer, and so it seems like I keep getting books like, well, here's another one talking about that. So that's something on my heart, you know, the facing when believers face tragedy and all of a sudden your life is stood on its head, and that's what I've been living with the last month.
Let me ask you, what has been the biggest challenge to your faith?
The biggest challenge to my faith, I guess, probably coming back home in 86. I never knew what a panic attack was in my life. And then I started having panic attacks, and I'd wake up in the middle of the night and didn't know what was going on. I thought I was having a heart attack and a cold sweat. And so this went on for weeks. In the meantime, I was pouring concrete, which was a good thing because I was doing heavy physical work. I was in the class on the weekends, filling in for in a church where they didn't have a pastor. So I was focused, but I walked through some darkness for about 6 weeks probably.
Mm.
And that was just because having been ripped, my roots ripped out after spending 30 years overseas and coming home and walking into a bank and not being able to cash a check, pulling into a gas station, not being able to get gas out of the pump because there's nobody there to talk to.
Mm-hmm.
And just total, like I was a, you know, I just come from another planet and what am I doing mm-hmm. here? Those were very challenging times. But God is, you know, but what I found is that wherever we've been, nothing is wasted. I use everything I've ever learned overseas, culture, language, not some of the languages, but the culture. Because we live in a community here that has over 10,000 Native Americans of the Yakima tribe. And there's never a day goes by in jail. We don't have at least 100 Native Americans in jail. We have people from all over the world that have come, all over the world. Where could you have people from China sitting in my office and we dialed mainland China and this Chinese gentleman talked to his mother in China, and she's asking him, and I had a book from a multimedia language where they supply books of the different languages, and I just looked through it that last week, and I noticed in the Chinese language, streams in the desert, and that was in my head, and he talked, and his mother said to him something about that book, and he passed it to me, and I opened the book and pointed to him, and then he talked in Chinese to his mother, and there was off the place was charged with excitement for some reason. And then he told me afterwards, she told him to tell me, thank you. I've been praying for my son for 20 years. And you put that together. Yakima in a jail, and he's amongst these Chinese that came in a container and were found in the Seattle port where several died. And they were in our jail for several weeks, a whole bunch of them. And we had Chinese services because I found the Chinese pastor in Tri-Cities who came up once a week, and a lot of good things happen out of that. And, you know, we had it for Africa, India, and so the cross-cultural aspect of being able to relate with other people, other language cultures, always, it's been a blessing. So never wasted. Mm-hmm. It's just like, whoa, this is great.
What's the one practical thing Christians could do to improve the world?
It's really not complicated. It's love people. It's not look down at people because they're different language or culture or economic level. Look them in the eye and smile at them, even though they don't speak the language. That just speaks volumes, because people from another race and culture here, I have a brother-in-law who's Filipino, born in Manila, married my wife's sister. He was over here one day in a market, walking through the line, and he noticed the woman would not talk to him. She talked to his wife and look at him like he didn't have a brain in his head. He said that's the first time he'd ever experienced race hate in somebody looking at him. You know, where there's that tension.
Mm-hmm.
And of course, with the Muslim things that are going on, you know, Muslim people relate to love. You can't win argument with theology, but love is something they really relate to. And everybody that's worked with Muslims, to me, that I know of, say the same thing. And treating people with respect and loving them, mm-hmm. I think, is the biggest need.
Yeah. Do you have a favorite Bible verse?
One of my favorites is Jeremiah 33:3. Call unto me, and I will answer thee, and show thee great and mighty things that thou knowest not. The other, the whole chapter 6 of Matthew, about God taking care of you.
Aside from the Bible, what book would you recommend for a new Christian?
You know, I just read one, and he's put out another book. The author's Mark, I don't know how you pronounce his last name, C-A-H-I-L, Cahill, I guess. I just read this one, and it's one I'm going through again because it's very good. One Thing You Can't Do in Heaven.
Mm.
And this is about evangelism, and it's awesome. But he's written another book, and I can't put my finger on it right now. But that's a great book. Another book that's been a great blessing to me is the one I mentioned earlier, Streams in the Desert.
Mm-hmm.
A devotional. That's always been a great blessing to me, and it's still a favorite. I get requests for it in Spanish and in English and in Chinese.
Yes. So what do you think heaven is like?
What, you know, I just finished a book, and I highly recommend it. It's Randy Alcorn's book titled Heaven. That is the best book I've ever read on heaven. I read it one chapter a day as a devotional. It is absolutely awesome. It blows you away. There is so much more than you can imagine. It's not somebody sitting on his cloud strumming a harp. Man, there's so much more. So I visualize heaven as a very real place. The heaven that we commonly think of really is temporary. It's paradise. There's going to be heaven on earth, a new heaven, a new earth, wherein dwells righteousness. And Garden of Eden is, we weren't there, but we're going to be able to see something probably far surpassing the Garden of Eden.
I want to thank Marv and Cole for joining me today. Thanks, Marv. I appreciate it.
Hey, it's been a pleasure, Ken. God bless you. Thanks for giving your time.
Amazing and so glorious, so beautifully victorious, almost unbelievable, completely inconceivable, astoundingly divine, wonderfully sublime, incredibly, delightfully, stupendously, abundantly, emphatically, eternally, fantastically, remarkably, good news!
We've got good news for people in trouble, good news for people in pain, we've got good news for everybody, good news. Jesus is alive. Good news, Jesus is alive. Good news, Jesus is alive. Alive, alive, alive. Good news, Jesus is alive.